This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, April 7th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Last week, Russian troops withdrew from Bucha, a suburb of the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. Ukrainians began returning to the city over the weekend, and immediately photos and videos of the horrific aftermath of the Russian occupation started to emerge. According to President Volodymyr Zelensky, more than 300 civilians in the city were killed. Investigators have found evidence of torture, rape, beheading, and dismemberment, and the intentional burning of corpses. Ukrainian forces have dug a mass grave to accommodate the bodies. Zelensky has referred to the massacre in Bucha as evidence of genocide. This week marked the 30th anniversary of the start of the Bosnian War, which led to a genocide that killed more than 100,000 people, most of them Bosniaks. And today is the 28th anniversary of the start of the Rwandan genocide, which killed close to a million people, primarily from the Tutsi ethnic group. On Tuesday, Zelensky gave a speech before the UN Security Council, excoriating the Council for inaction in Ukraine.
It is obvious that the key institution of the world, which must ensure the coercion of any aggressor to peace, simply cannot work effectively. Now the world can see that what Russian military did in Bucha while keeping the city under their occupation, but the world has yet to see what they have done in other occupied cities and regions of our country. Geography might be different or various, but cruelty is the same, crimes are the same, and accountability must be inevitable.
Philip Gurevich, a New Yorker staff writer, has written for the magazine about the genocides in Rwanda and Cambodia. He joins me today to discuss his past reporting, why the never again discourse around genocides has failed to prevent them, and what the violence in Bucha and elsewhere in Ukraine tells us about Putin's war. Hi, Philip. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Good to be with you, Dorothy.
So there is no question that the conflicts in Rwanda and Bosnia resulted in genocide, but our colloquial understanding of the term isn't the same as the definition under international law. Could you explain the difference?
Yeah, I think that colloquially, most of us equate genocide with extermination. And that's for good reason, because the really major cases that we're all familiar with, the Holocaust of European Jews, the extirpation of Native Americans in the United States and Canada, the Armenians under the Ottomans, and of Rwandan Tutsis at the hands of Hutu power. These were all crimes of extermination as well as of genocide. But the law, the international law governing genocide, which is called the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide, that defines genocide not by the enormity of the criminal act, but the enormity of criminal intent. Maybe I should just read to you a little sentence or so from the law, which I find instructive and also will probably ring bells with Ukraine. It says, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. A, killing members of the group. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And E, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. So it's a problematic definition with the terms in whole or in part, but it's about intent, and so it's there are plenty of other war crimes that describe what we're seeing in Ukraine, but it's the specific language that surrounds it, and the population transfer, and the wanton, you know, sort of extermination of men of a certain age in some of these cases. This is all, let's just say, pretty clearly comes into focus as genocidal, whether or not there's been a formal designation of genocide at this point.
And why the focus on intent rather than criminal acts, since intent is really the trickiest thing to prove?
Because it's a tricky crime as such, because that's what there is a crime of extermination under the war crimes law. There are crimes that cover all the different kinds of mass murder, mutilation, civilian killing of, you know, I'm not using the technical legal terms, but the actual acts that we see. But it's the specific nature of a crime that is designed to wipe out a group, to destroy it in whole or in part. Now, the in part piece of the language is complicated because it seems to suggest, well, gee, what's the difference between a hate crime and genocide? Because it's about intent in both cases. But we obviously, one of the ways that you establish the intent to destroy is by the scale of the destruction. So it's a combination of factors that stack together. And you can establish a lot of things without always being able to establish genocide. But in some cases, I think quite often when it does rise to this level, it's not that hard to at least establish, if not in a legal context, in a historical, journalistic, political context, to be able to say they're broadcasting their intention. The perpetrators of these things are rarely just emerging out of nowhere and suddenly going berserk. You usually have a long history of incremental destruction of that group or attempts to destroy that group. In this case, you have the prior invasion of Ukraine. You have the examples of Chechnya, the war there under Putin, which was a war of total eradication of Grozny. You have the crimes in Syria, which are more akin to war crimes than to genocide, because there was never any explicit intent to say Syria doesn't exist and Syrians must cease to exist.
Yeah, and I want to get to all of that in a second. But first, I wanted to say that you and I have been working together long enough that I vividly remember in 1995 when you went off to report your first piece about Rwanda for the magazine. Maybe you could tell our listeners what it was you went to find out.
In 1995, I went basically a year afterwards to find out in part how people understood what had happened there and also how they were dealing in the most immediate aftermath. Rwanda was barely functional at that point. It was still very devastated. It was a country about the size of West Virginia, where in 1994, there were about 7.5 million people. Close to 1 million had been killed. About 2 million had fled, and at least 40% of those who remained were displaced at the end of the genocide in the summer of 94. And of course, because while it was happening here in America, the Clinton administration was trying to say, it's not a genocide. They didn't want to call it a genocide at the time. And their reason was not that they were defending the genocidaire explicitly, but because the Convention on Genocide is the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. And there was an understanding up until that point that if you designate something that is underway as a genocide, you carry a burden to take preventive action. And the Clinton administration was very interested in not getting any such burden. So there was a famous press conference where they were using these Clintonian terms, you know, acts of genocide may have occurred. And a Reuters reporter said, well, how many acts of genocide does it take to make a genocide? And finally, Warren Christopher, who was the Secretary of State, said, well, I don't see why it's such a magic word. I'm happy to call it a genocide. It doesn't oblige us to act. It just permits us to act, which was a very original interpretation of it. But it's one that has prevailed since. People have not felt that the obligation to act was absolutely attached to the designation.
So here we are now. It's impossible not to be shocked by the images and the reporting we've been seeing from Bucha and other cities. But this isn't the first mass atrocity perpetrated on Ukraine. In the early 30s, Stalin engineered a famine that killed millions of Ukrainians. Zelensky and other Ukrainians have persistently reminded the West of this history and of Putin's murderous ambitions, but they were initially ignored. And again, is it for some of the same reasons you've just been describing, that the Clinton administration just didn't want to confront this head on?
I think there are a number of reasons here. It's much more complex. Like in Rwanda existed as a tiny country with almost no natural resources, that was incredibly poor, landlocked, and in the center of Africa, really very much outside the strategic concerns of the great powers. This is the opposite. Here, you have a nuclear power with a leader who repeatedly threatens to use his nuclear arsenal if anybody tries to stop him from doing what he thinks is entirely his business in his sphere of influence. The fact that you've got a power like that, the fact that we had a president, by the way, who supported, admired, and paved the way for Putin. So for years, we had not just a policy of head in the sand, we had the policy of actually saying, like, that's a great leader there, Putin. And when this buildup began last year, I mean, we actually see that the Americans had very good intelligence, and we're very much aware of it. The leverage that's been used is a combination of supplying the kind of military aid that they feel that they can supply, but also sanctions. And sanctions, as has been widely debated, it's a very limited tool, even if you use it very aggressively, because it's a kind of warfare, obviously, when you use it at the scale that it's being used. But we're hoping that maybe if we make the people around him suffer enough, people will either make an appeal to Putin or it'll put pressure on Putin to back off or back down. That's a long-range plan. And, you know, in Russia, these oligarchs, here our oligarchs have enormous political power because they pay for the political system as donors and as patrons of politicians. There, the politicians are patrons of the oligarchs. It's not at all clear what leverage they have on Putin.
Yeah, and I want to get back to this definition of the enormity of criminal intent, because this, I just think this is so important. Many of Putin's most vocal critics tend to end up poisoned or shot. His war tactics are completely familiar, as you alluded to above. Those Russia's airstrikes against Syrian civilians and hospitals enabled Syrian President Assad to beat back his opposition. And now we're seeing the bombing of urban areas in Ukraine, which follows verbatim the Russian model used in the bombing of Aleppo. If the standard of genocidal activity is criminal intent, then surely Putin has broadcast his intent.
He has, but, you know, it's a combination of intent and acts that show that intent. And then you have to be able to prove that there's a direct connection between one and the other. And, you know, if you're trying to get into the legal side of it, if you're trying to get into the question of what's he up to here, it's clear that he's in a kind of total war. And I think one of the reasons he's been able to get as far as he has, you ask about sort of the larger neglect of his various signals over the years, you know, there's the problem also of unifying all of the various European allies. And he was obviously betting on the idea that the response would be weak. And we have seen Europe, on the one hand, being unified more than it was expected. But on the other hand, we're bankrolling him. At least Germany's bankrolling him by its dependence on his fossil fuel. So I just think this is an exceptionally complex challenge, and it's likely to be one that goes on for a long time. I think it's pretty clear that the Americans and a number of the Europeans are sending a lot of quite effective arms to Ukraine, and it's in the hands of these Ukrainian fighters who are really fighting, which was not something anybody fully expected. Even I suspect the Ukrainians themselves didn't know that they would be so effective against Russia.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So I want to ask you about prevention. You mentioned Putin's annexation of Crimea beginning in 2014. Is there anything that the West could have done at that point to have deterred Putin from further violence?
I'm not an expert on those mechanisms, but I would say that it seems, you know, they might have tried harder sanctions that hit harder sooner. Would that have, I mean, they did a lot of sanctions, but they could have done a lot more. They could have recognized that weaning from his oil supply was critical to disabling him. But it's very difficult to tell whether there's any leverage on this man. He does not have internal rivals. I mean, there are not a lot of other centers of power in Russia that seem able to check him. He seems to be able to use a monopoly over media to dominate the information sphere. He has substantial support in the West. He has Orbán, just won re-election in Hungary. Serbia, same thing. Marine Le Pen, she's a Putinist, and she's a strong contender for the presidency of France. We have 63 congressmen in the United States in the Republican Party who voted against a resolution in Congress just a couple days ago, reaffirming that we fully support NATO, 63 members of Congress. So we're in a very complex situation. It's not clear where the levers are. We've isolated Russia tremendously. It's going to be very hard to keep that coalition together because up till now, we have not really felt the pain within the Western societies. And you have India willing to buy oil. Germany's happy to join the sanctions until it means the discomfort of actually not buying the oil. And what are you going to threaten him with? But the fact is, people don't know how to prevent these things because they're not prepared to go all the way out on a limb, either militarily or otherwise, to stop something that hasn't happened.
I want to ask you, too, about the use of diplomacy in a ghastly period like Ukraine is living through and the whole world is living through right now. Last month, President Biden was very widely criticized for an impromptu remark he made about Putin after a very serious speech in Poland. And he just said, for God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. And he seemed to be endorsing regime change. That wasn't a message his administration wanted to send. But it did remind me of Michael Kinsley's adage, a gaffe is when a politician tells the truth. What was your response at the time?
Mixed, because we know Biden is prone to going off script, but he doesn't go off. He often goes off script to say something that is, in fact, you know, him just kind of being folksy and leveling. And he did send a message that many people remarked that's really heartening to the people who are resisting. You know, some people likened it to the Reagan tear down this wall, which seemed like either a kind of piece of political theater or heightened rhetoric. But when Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, turn down this wall, that gave tremendous courage to people on the other side of that wall. But obviously, it's not clear at all that there was any advantage for the president of the United States at this moment to say that out loud. The press, I think, made a heyday of it and really used it as an excuse to completely ignore the serious speech that he gave in Warsaw and keep nagging about the gaffe. And over and over and over, he was asked, like, don't you think you've created a catastrophe? It's a stupid question to ask a president. What do they want him to say? So what he said, in fact, was very good. He said, I was expressing my outrage. It was a personal expression of outrage. Okay, that's a hair-splitting thing, and it's an attempt to walk it back a little bit. But he also said, but if you think that it's provoking him, he can't be provoked. He's going to do whatever he wants to do, this guy. And I think he's right about that. And so there may be a value to having told the truth, but it also seems ill-advised because it wasn't intended. And right now, staying on script, which for the most part, Biden has done very, very firmly and has, you know, quite effectively rallied a much more substantial and united world response than anybody would have expected. It seems like there's a lot of value in him staying on script. But how this ends with Putin still in power, I don't think anybody's got a scenario.
And in the meantime, the International Criminal Court has opened an investigation into possible war crimes in Ukraine. But it seems highly unlikely that Putin will ever stand trial. And if that's the case, what use is the ICC?
I mean, the main reason he's unlikely to stand any kind of trial is because he would have to be captured. And that is not really the kind of game that a guy like this plays. I mean, he's in it for keeps. He's not looking for a peaceful retirement, it doesn't look to me. He is a kind of apocalyptic leader at this point. And so that seems to be the chief obstacle. There are various kinds of jurisdiction, but there's a lot of value to documenting and creating a record of these things. And it's possible that Russia itself would have to have reparations, or that other people in the chain of command. And in seeking, in some sort of an aftermath, to manage the situation and bring about some sort of a new order in its aftermath, the courts are an important possible tool. But they're not going to bring about anything like, you know, justice is this word that we use really loosely. You'd get the law, not justice. Like, what's the justice for somebody, for these villages that have been wiped out and whose families have been killed? Reparations actually are often what victims of these things want most. Who's going to rebuild all of this? Who's going to pay for that? How's that going to happen? What price is there to pay for Russia and the Russian military down the road? But these are things that have to be dealt with in the immediate moment because the crimes are being committed and need to be documented. But it would be a very long time before any of that would happen. And the resolution of the war is almost inevitably going to precede that. War crimes prosecutions are not how you resolve a war. They're what you do when you get a war under control.
Right. So to that point, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told Congress this week that only the presence of U.S. forces could have prevented the Russian invasion and that the war is likely to drag on for years. As we've said, even the heaviest sanctions aren't going to deter Putin. So can anything be done short of direct involvement by NATO to prevent further atrocities?
I mean, I don't think that direct involvement by NATO is in the cards, on the table. And I think that in different ways, Putin has been hoping to bait NATO and specifically America into it. They are calling it Biden's war on Russian television, because that gives it a kind of legitimacy. It's a war against the West and its aggressions and its humiliations of us and its all of these things. So if they can drag us in, that's a win for him, even if it's not a military win. It gives the whole war a kind of shape that he would like it to have and that he's been claiming it has. And I think Biden and pretty much everybody else in NATO has been very staunch about the idea that they do not want to be directly involved. And so I think that what we do see is a lot of arms going that way, and the Ukrainians are fighting like hell. And they're is a lot of willingness by the United States and by other NATO allies and other neighboring EU states to provide them with an awful lot more, which is some sort of a gray area in between getting fully involved and not being involved.
Thanks so much, Philip.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Philip Gravitch is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda. He is working on a new book about the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.